She took a bunch of pills, then slit her wrists in the bathroom. By the time her parents found her, she was already gone. They called me that night to break the news to me. I loved her as much as they did. I would never have another friend like Mia. Mia was gone, and it was all Natalie's fault. I wanted vengeance. I tried to convince Mia's parents to do something, press charges against Natalie, but there was no evidence Natalie did anything wrong. It was Natalie's word against a dead girl, and everyone loved Natalie. Mia's parents just wanted to forget about it. Let her rest in peace, Dawn. I couldn't, though. I was too angry. My hatred for Natalie Farrell burned inside of me. I watched as she went off to college and dated the hottest guys and made a zillion new friends and did all the things that Mia would never do because of her. There was nothing I could do about it. Nobody cared except me. Even Mia's own parents were willing to let it go. And then one day I found somebody who hated Natalie as much as I did. Someone who blamed her for killing Mia the same way I did. Who wasn't going to let it go as easily as her parents were. Caleb, Mia's brother. Chapter 48. Natalie. Since I've been arrested, I'm entitled to have an attorney provided for me. The smart thing to do would be to hire a lawyer of my own, but I'm incredibly short on funds right now, and whatever I do have, I'd like to save it to bail myself out. So I consent to use the freebie lawyer. Right now I'm supposed to be having a meeting with my lawyer. They've led me into one of the interrogation rooms, lit by an overly bright bulb right over my head, and I've been sitting in an uncomfortable plastic chair for the last 45 minutes, waiting for an attorney named Archibald Ferguson that I'm increasingly certain will never show up. If only I had money to pay for my own lawyer. But I'm pretty sure the Constitution or something says that I have a right to an attorney. They can't just say they gave me one and wash their hands of it. Finally, the door to the interrogation room swings open. But my heart sinks when I see that it's just some teenager, probably a high school intern working at the police department, dressed in one of his father's oversized suits. But I may as well make the best of it. "Could I have some water?" I asked the intern. "My throat is really parched. And do you think you can ask them how much longer till my lawyer shows up?" The boy clears his throat.
"Actually, I'm your lawyer."
I stare up at the kid, all thoughts of my parched throat flying out of my head. This has got to be some kind of joke. This is a child. He doesn't even look like he's old enough to grow facial hair. How could he be a lawyer? How could he be my lawyer?
"What?"
I sputter.
"I'm your lawyer,"
he repeats, although it doesn't seem more plausible the second time he says it.
"I'm Archie Ferguson."
He holds out his smooth white hand, but I don't take it. "How old are you?" He flinches.
"I'm 25.
I suppose that's better than when I first took him for, which is 16, but not much better. This kid does not look like he is in any position to be defending somebody in a murder trial. He looks more like he should be working the drive-thru at McDonald's. "You're a lawyer?" I ask. He nods proudly.
"I graduated this past June."
"Great. He's been a lawyer for 5 months. I want to bury my face in my hands and burst into tears. But somehow, I manage to hold it together. Ferguson settles into the chair across from me. His suit is at least two sizes too big for his skinny frame. It must belong to his dad or a big brother. He'll grow into it, I suppose. By then, I'll be serving 25 years to life.
"So let's talk about your case, Miss Farley,"
he begins.
"Farrell."
I glare at him across the almost comically tiny table. "My name is Farrell." Ferguson frowns. He looks down at a stack of loose papers in front of him and starts shuffling through them.
"Farrell? Are you sure? I thought..."
"I know my own name."
Right, of course."
Ferguson's voice cracks because apparently still going through puberty.
"Sorry, Miss Farrell."
I don't say anything to that.
"So,"
he says. I raise an eyebrow. "Yes?" He clears his throat, which turns into a cough, then a series of coughs. Finally, he jumps up, explaining that he has to go get some water. He runs out of the room, grabbing his sweaty stack of papers, and then he returns about 10 minutes later.
"Sorry about that," he says,
as he plops down in the chair across from me. I just stare at him.
So, he coughs again, and I swear to God I'm going to lose it if he has another coughing fit. Let's discuss your, case.
Listen, I say. No offense, Mr. Ferguson, but this case is kind of a big deal. This is a murder trial. Is there anyone else who could help me? Like somebody with a little more experience? Ferguson's cheeks turn bright red.
I've been doing this for almost 6 months. I've tried a lot of cases. Don't worry. You're in good hands.
I am worried, though. I chew in my thumbnail. This is a murder charge, you know? He nods slowly.
Yeah, this is a tough one. They have a pretty good case against you. A lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff? How could that be? How much stuff could they possibly have against me when I haven't done anything?
Like what? Like, they got into that shift woman's emails, and she wrote all about the things you did to her.
He tugs at his tie, which doesn't seem to be knotted correctly.
She cataloged the way you bullied her at work, and that she caught you embezzling money from the company where you both worked, and the two of you were supposed to meet that night.
That's complete fiction. My heart is pounding. I was nice to Dawn, and we weren't supposed to meet that night. I don't know what she could possibly be talking about.
Also, he says, your fingerprints were on the handle of a knife in her house.
I explained that. I picked up the knife to defend myself in case there was an intruder in the house, and it wasn't like she was stabbed to death. Ferguson smiles apologetically.
Also, he adds, the police found blood and hair in the trunk of your car. It matches up to what they found in Schiff's apartment.
My mouth falls open. They found Dawn's blood and hair in my trunk? I can't even begin to explain that one.
Not to mention, he goes on.
Oh my God, there's more?
Your boyfriend's statement is extremely damaging. That's going to be a hard one to rip apart.
Is it really that bad? I ask. I mean, yes, we weren't together that night.
And you lied about it.
I wince. Yes, I did. But have you seen that detective? He's terrifying. And I didn't make a statement under oath. I just didn't have an alibi for that night. There are plenty of people who don't have an alibi for Monday night.
Ferguson gives me a funny look. That's not all your boyfriend said.
This completely isn't fair. I squeeze my right hand into a fist. Santoro was harassing Caleb. He found him and forced him to say a bunch of things he probably didn't mean.
No, that's not what happened at all. Caleb McCullough came to the station voluntarily. He told them he wanted to make a statement, and they recorded it. I saw the transcript.
I blink at him, wondering if I heard him right. Caleb asked to make a statement.
That's right.
But my thoughts won't stop racing. This doesn't sound right. What did he say?
It's, not good.
Ferguson rifles through the pile of papers in front of him until I want to rip them out of his hands.
He said you pressured him into lying about being together that night. He said that he left your house at around 9:30, after you asked him to leave. Apparently, you told him you had somewhere to be.
What? I cry. That's ridiculous. That's a complete lie.
Well, that's what he said. He also said that you and Dawn didn't get along, that you were constantly picking on her, that the two of you hated each other.
My head is spinning. Caleb said that about me? Why would he say that? He barely knew Dawn, and he wasn't even around work that much. And even if he did think I was bullying Dawn, why would he say that to the police? It's a pretty awful thing to say about your girlfriend.
As you can see, Ferguson says, they have a strong case against you. But there is some good news.
Like what? I choke out. At this rate, I'm looking at life in prison.
Well, he says, they don't have a dead body.
My head snaps up. What? I don't understand. The detective said they found Dawn's body beaten to death.
Actually,
he shuffles through the papers in front of him again.
They were having trouble identifying the body because she was beaten so badly and her teeth were destroyed, so dental records couldn't be used. But DNA testing has now revealed that it was not Dawn Schiff.
My head is spinning. Another girl about the same age turned up dead right in our neighborhood? It seems like a crazy coincidence, but I suppose a good number of people are murdered in big cities, and some percentage of them are going to be young women. So she might not even be dead? He gives me a look, Based on the amount of blood on the floor of her house, plus the blood in my car, and the fact that she has not resurfaced, all point to the fact that she is almost certainly dead, and I am still very much the prime suspect. Can I be convicted of murder if there's no body? I ask.
It's harder, but still possible. I think you have a good chance of getting bail.
That would be great news if I had any chance of being able to afford the bail. But what about a conviction? I press him. He hesitates.
These are some really serious charges, Miss Farrell, and the DA has a super strong case, like I said. Given the circumstances, your best bet is to confess and take a plea bargain.
Confess? I cry. But I didn't do anything. Ferguson flashes me a skeptical look.
You know, we have that attorney-client confidentiality thingy. It's better if you tell me the truth, so I can help you. I'm not allowed to tell anyone, so you should be honest with me.
I didn't, I insist. I swear.
Ferguson frowns. He might be young, but apparently 5 months of defending criminals have already made him jaded. Fine, he says. But either way, it might be worth taking a plea bargain. Go to prison for a few years, then you'll be out. If we take a chance and go to trial, especially if the body surfaces, you'll be looking at life in prison.
Life in prison. Life in prison. Ferguson starts talking about the bail hearing on Monday, but I can barely focus on what he is saying. Life in prison. Those three words keep repeating in my head over and over. If this goes badly, I could be living in a cell until the day I die, behind bars. That's even worse than a cubicle. Life in prison. I can't let that happen to me. I can't. If it looks like I'm going down for this, if it looks like I might spend the rest of my life in prison, I'm going to end it all. I'll drive back out to Wollaston Beach, and I'll throw myself off the pier in the middle of the night at high tide. Nobody will be able to save me. But I hope it doesn't come to that. There was a girl in my high school who committed suicide, and it was so incredibly tragic. Something I couldn't stop thinking about for years to come. Except, now I get it. I finally understand the hopelessness that girl must have felt when she took her own life. The feeling that it would be better to be swallowed up into the abyss than continue to live life as you know it. I can't let that happen to me. I can't.
Chapter 49. Dawn.
Turtles have interesting mating habits. The male turtle often follows the female around, sniffing near their cloacal opening before starting a courtship ritual. While the male and female are going at it, they twist their tails together as the semen passes from the male to the female. But the female doesn't have to lay her eggs right away. She can hold on to the sperm for several years before laying her eggs, if she so desires. Caleb always gets sleepy after we have sex. Do all human men do that? I'm not sure. Caleb is the only man I've ever been with. I'm sure he's the only man I will ever be with. If not for him, I would still almost certainly still be a virgin. I wouldn't have lost it to a turtle, as Natalie helpfully pointed out. I'm watching more videos on his phone. My head propped up with the pillow, and he's lying next to me, his arm slung across my chest. When he first came here, it seemed like it was urgent that we get out of this motel. But now he says we've already paid up for the rest of the evening, so we don't have to rush. I suppose with Natalie in jail, things are at a standstill. Do you want to watch it too? I ask him, tilting the phone in his direction. He yawns. That's okay. I was there, remember? He squeezes me with his arm, cuddling closer to me. I reconnected with Caleb about a year after Mia died. I came to see her parents, and he was there. I knew Caleb from when we were younger, but I never paid much attention to my friend's big brother back then, although I always liked him because I knew he was protective of Mia. When I saw him all those years later, I was taken aback by how tall and cute he was. I got crushes on boys sometimes, but I had learned to ignore them. I knew by now that none of the boys would ever like me back. Caleb is Mia's half-brother. His father died when he was young and his mother remarried. That's why they have different last names. He adored his baby sister,
and he had spent the last year blaming himself for letting this happen to her. He didn't even know about Natalie. Not all of it, anyway. I spent the rest of the day filling him in. He was beyond furious. When I went back to college, we vowed to keep in touch. Mostly, we talked about Natalie, and to a lesser extent, her friend Tara. What Natalie had done to Mia, and how to get her to pay. We never had any concrete ideas, though. Well, I suggested cornering her in a dark alley, but Caleb wouldn't go along with that idea. He was adamant about not wanting to hurt anyone physically, and that limited our options. Mostly it was just fantasies. We can't just let her get away with it, Caleb would say. It's not right. I can't remember exactly when it seemed like our friendship was evolving into something different. We never had the same sort of friendship that Mia and I had. I never expected that. But I noticed he was looking at me in a different way than most people. I didn't quite understand it. 3 years from the time of Mia's death, Caleb and I were at a restaurant together and having quite a nice evening. For once, the silverware was clean, and the glasses didn't have smudges on them that required them to be replaced. When the check arrived, Caleb grabbed for it. "No," I protested, "it's my turn to pay." Caleb and I always took turns covering the check when we went out. If there was a significant discrepancy between that evening's check and the last time, I would offer him money to cover the difference. "I want to pay," he told me as he tugged the bill out of my fingers. When I started to protest, he added, "I got a raise at work." "All right," I finally agreed, albeit reluctantly, "but let me at least make sure it's correct." I looked over the numbers, and sure enough, there was a major error. They charged us for 2 beers, but Caleb had ordered one. "I saved you $6, I told him rather proudly. "What would you do without me?" "You're right," he agreed. "I don't know what I'd do without you." Then I noticed he was looking at me with a lopsided smile on his face. I didn't quite know what he was thinking until he blurted out, "Dawn, would it be okay if I kissed you?" I was stunned. I noticed he'd been treating me differently, but this was something entirely unexpected. Nobody had ever kissed me before, and yet I was oddly touched that he asked permission, which was what inspired me to say yes. It was my first kiss, and it was so much better than I ever imagined it would be. It was the first of many, and it wasn't until we had kissed at least a dozen times that he stopped asking permission. And then I somehow fell in love with him. He loves me too. Before this, he was talking about getting married. He wants to marry me, even though I am me. Ultimately, I am certain he will be disappointed. Mia accepted me for exactly who I am, but I suspect Caleb sees something in me that isn't there. More concerning, the deeper he fell in love with me, the more his hatred of Natalie seemed to dissipate. He didn't talk about her much anymore. He didn't want to get revenge. It was a long time ago, he started saying. That's when I knew. We had to do it now, before he completely lost his desire. "We should hit the road in about an hour," he says in that same sleepy voice that makes me think he isn't going to want to get on the road at all in an hour. "I found another motel we can go to, about 30 miles south of here." "Okay," I agree. He props his head up on his elbow. "I thought maybe I could spend the night with you. I think it's safe." "You think?" He bats his eyes at me. "Let's live dangerously." I can't very well argue with him after I made the stupid move of calling Natalie from the motel. And I would like him to spend the night. These motels are frightening after dark. "I wonder if they figured out that dead body isn't me," I muse. "I haven't seen it mentioned on the news." "If they haven't, I'm sure they will soon," he says. "I guess they had to do DNA tests since her face was so damaged. That takes time." "I guess so." He rubs the stubble on his chin. "It's such a crazy coincidence, isn't it? I mean, a girl the same age as you turns up at the exact same time." He keeps saying that. He keeps talking about what a strange coincidence it is. But it's not that strange. Thousands of women are murdered every year in this country. It's a coincidence. He doesn't need to give me a funny look when he says it. "How long do you think she'll go to jail for?" I muse. "A long time, I bet." "You think?" "Sure, I mean, it's a murder charge." I chew on my lower lip. But as soon as the DNA tests show that the dead woman isn't me, there won't be a body. They can't lock her away for life if there's no dead body, can they?
Well, there's nothing we can do about that, is there?
I guess not. Caleb tilts my head so he can kiss me. My stomach churns as I push away the thought that's been intruding on my brain for the last month or so. As much as I try not to let it bother me, it's hard not to think about it, though. He kissed her. He kissed Natalie. At first, I didn't think it was a big deal, but now every time his lips are on mine, I imagine him kissing her. I saw the two of them kissing, and if I didn't know better, I would have thought he was enjoying it. He probably was enjoying it on some level. I'm sure she kisses very well. She's had lots of experience.
What was it like kissing her?
I blurt out. His lips part slightly.
Excuse me?
When you kissed Natalie, I clarify. What was it like? His face darkens.
What do you think? It was awful. I hated it.
Really? Because it didn't look like you hated it that much when you were doing it.
I quickly add, I'm just wondering, I'm not mad.
Caleb sits up all the way in bed. There's a muscle twitching in his jaw.
This is the last thing I want to talk about.
Well, it just seems like you didn't mind playing the part that much. Just an observation. I don't know why I'm doing this. We got exactly what we wanted. And a large part of it is because Caleb went out with Natalie. But I can't help the way I'm feeling.
You've got to be kidding me, Dawn, he growls. You know I didn't want to go out with her. I didn't want to do any of that. I told you no, but you kept pushing and pushing.
That is not inaccurate. Caleb did not, in fact, want to date Natalie. He thought it would be enough just to be friendly with her. But I felt like he could incriminate her so much better if he were her boyfriend. So I talked him into it. It actually took quite a bit of work because he really, really didn't want to do it. But I was relentless. I wouldn't give up until he agreed.
You didn't have to do it,
I pointed out. You could have refused.
Have you ever met you? He shoots back.
I'm just saying.
You made me do it. You begged me. You cried.
I did put on quite the performance, and it wasn't an act. It's that important to me to get Natalie behind bars. So yes, I did tear up a bit. But deep down, I was still hoping he would refuse. Because you see, Caleb is supposed to love me and only me. And if you really love a woman, you would never agree to kiss another woman. Not under any circumstances. Caleb frowns.
You know, I didn't even sleep with her. And believe me, that wasn't easy.
Oh, I'm sure.
I didn't mean it like that. I'm just saying I didn't do anything with her.
Except kiss her.
Yes, but that's it. And I hated it. I wanted to throw up after.
He's lying. He doesn't hate Natalie the way I do. He was going to let the whole thing go. When I suggested getting jobs at Vic's to set her up and send her to prison, which is what she deserves, Caleb looked at me like I was crazy. 10 years ago, he would have been happy to go along with it. But I had to force him to do it now, kicking and screaming. Mia has been dead for 13 years now, and it feels like I'm the only one who truly cares anymore. Even her own brother has forsaken her. I still care, Mia. I did this all for you. Natalie is going to pay. Those emails left on my computer were a stroke of brilliance. Who is stupid enough to leave their computer password on a sticky note under their mouse pad? But I'm sure the police bought it. Those emails I composed to Mia were a work of art. I'm so glad Mia could play a little part in the plan to take down the woman who killed her. Caleb even set up an untraceable fake account for Mia to reply to the emails and make it all seem more real. Caleb composed dozens of fake emails allegedly from Mia, and we gave her the life she always wanted. She always dreamed of living on the West Coast and, of course, being married to George. In my emails, I painted Natalie to be a psychopath, and it all but says she was at my house on the night of the disappearance. Then there's the bloody ceramic turtle Caleb planted in her laundry hamper, and her fingerprints strategically scattered throughout my house. and one more damning little surprise. She's finished. There's no way she isn't going down for murder. Caleb reaches for my hand. He laces his fingers into mine. I saw Natalie hold his hand like this once.
You're not really upset over this, are you?
No, it's fine. I lie. We should get on the road soon. Caleb nods. We both get out of bed and start getting dressed. It's lucky Natalie told him that she had traced my calls. If she hadn't, it could have ruined everything. That was a very close call. I'm not going to take any chances anymore. This has to go exactly to plan.
Chapter 50. Natalie. I've never spent the night in jail.
Obviously.
I'm not the sort of person who gets hauled in by the police. I don't get drunk and make a spectacle of myself in public. I don't do drugs. In general, I follow all the laws to a T. Yet, here I am. There's something inhuman about being kept in a cage this way. It makes me feel less like a person and more like some sort of animal. It's stifling, claustrophobic. I'm in a tiny cell with one other woman. She's not much bigger than me, but she's absolutely terrifying. She has pockmarks all over her face and a jagged scar splitting one of her eyebrows in half. She has tattoos everywhere. She even has them on her neck. I once tried to get a tattoo, and I chickened out. And that was going to be a tiny heart on my shoulder blade. How gutsy do you have to be to let somebody tattoo a giant skull on your neck? They shut off the lights inside the cell when it's time for bed, but they're still on in the hallway right outside the bars. It's these fluorescent lights that keep flickering. It's even worse than the ones at work. I can't sleep with that going on, but it's not like I can ask them to shut the lights out. Plus, the cell would be far more terrifying if it were pitch black. And the stench of urine is almost overpowering to the point where I want to breathe through my mouth. The gray mystery meat I eat for dinner churns in my stomach. When I got here, they gave me the option of changing out of my 5K t-shirt and running pants into a jumpsuit. At the time, it seemed like a good idea, but now I regret it. This jumpsuit is itching like crazy. I don't know if it's the detergent or what. At home, I use a hypoallergenic detergent, but I'm guessing the jail laundry doesn't have that. At least there's a bed in the room so I don't have to sleep on the floor. But I might as well be. There seems to be a mattress on the bed, but it's not much better than a sleeping bag. Also, it's freezing. All they have given me is a paper-thin wool blanket that's possibly itchier than the jumpsuit. Yet, I'm obscenely grateful to have it. I don't even know how it's so cold. The winter hasn't even started yet. It's got to be colder in here than it is outside. I just want to sleep. Is that too much to hope for?
Hey, you.
I roll my head in the direction of the other bed in the cell. It's the woman with the neck tattoos.
What?
I say.
It's cold in here, she says.
I know. I shiver under the itchy wool blanket. It's freezing. Do you think we should tell the guard? The woman laughs.
Yeah. What do you think he's going to do? Turn up the thermostat?
I don't know.
Listen, I need your blanket.
I shift on the poor excuse for a mattress.
What do you mean? I mean I'm cold. I need your blanket.
But then I won't have a blanket.
Like I give a shit.
But the woman climbs out of her bed. She straightens up and crosses the small cell. And now I'm absolutely terrified. She bends down close enough to me that I can smell her stale breath. She reaches out one arm, and I flinch. Sure, she's going to punch me in the face and break my nose. But instead, she grabs my blanket and yanks it clear off me. If I was uncomfortable before, it's a lot worse now. I didn't realize how much warmth that skimpy blanket was providing me. Without it, I'm practically shaking. But my cellmate doesn't care. I'm lucky she left me with my pillow, even though it's flat as a pancake. I lie on my back, still shivering, trying to get some sleep. This is going to be my life from now on. I don't have enough money to make bail, so I'm stuck here until my trial. And if the trial goes as badly as my attorney has warned me it will, this could be the rest of my life. Before I know it, tears are streaming down my cheeks. I don't cry easily, but this last thing has broken me. Losing my itchy, crappy blanket has broken me. I wiped the tears away with the back of my hand because it would be too much to hope for a tissue.
Hey, my cellmate snaps. Keep it down over there. I'm trying to sleep.
How did my life get to this point? I never laid a finger on Dawn. How could they think I would kill her? Why won't anyone believe me? Chapter 51. Dawn.
Caleb decides it's safer to wait until late to leave the motel. So it's well into the evening by the time we arrive at the new motel. It looks exactly like the other one. Identical. It's like we just drove around the block for 40 minutes and arrived exactly where we started. But Caleb is the one who picked it, and I don't feel like complaining. It's not like some other place would be better. Any place nicer than this is probably going to pay more attention to who is checking in, and that's the last thing we want. Caleb goes into the main lobby to get us a room. I am wearing my wig and baseball cap, and my spare tortoiseshell glasses are in my coat pocket. I duck down in the seat, but it's not like it matters. The outside of the motel is poorly lit, and there's hardly anyone around anyway. I probably look more suspicious crouching down. About 10 minutes later, he returns to the car, a key jangling in his hand.
Second floor again, he tells me.
I grab the small bag containing the meager belongings I chanced bringing with me. It's a few pairs of jeans, underwear, some shirts. Turtly, and that's about it. If I took too much, the police might think I went on a trip instead of coming to the conclusion we want them to reach. I sling the bag on my shoulder and follow Caleb out of the car and up to the motel room. The motel room has the same dingy look as the last place. Everything seems to be covered in a layer of grime. Not the kind of grime that will come off on your finger if you touch it. Grime that's been built in from years of overuse of already second-rate furniture. When Caleb flicks on the light, there's even grime on the lampshade. I scrutinize the bed. The thin blanket is brown, and when I yank it loose, the sheets underneath are a pale yellow color, and the pillowcase is gray. Does anyone even make the slightest attempt to match the linen? I can't even fathom pairing a gray pillowcase with yellow sheets. He notices the expression on my face.
Sorry, it's not nicer. It's fine. It's far from fine. There's nothing I can do about the sheets, but I will spend all day tomorrow scrubbing this room until the level of grime becomes acceptable.
It's good enough.
It's only for a few days.
Right. A few days and off to the next place, which will be exactly the same. I pull off my wig and baseball cap, and then I spend a good minute scratching my scalp. That wig is awful. I should probably try to grow out my hair, but I hate having long hair. I hate the way my hair feels against my skin.
Can I have your phone? I ask.
Caleb reaches into his pocket and pulls out his iPhone. He hands it over to me, and I immediately look up news updates. I'm searching for articles about Natalie. I want to know if there's anything new in the case. My heart sinks when I discover an article announcing that police have confirmed that the identity of the dead body found in Cohasset was not, in fact, John Schiff.
They found out the body wasn't me, I say.
He doesn't seem particularly concerned.
It was going to happen sooner or later.
Do you think Natalie will get out on bail? I wonder aloud.
I don't know.
She probably will. I put down the phone on the bed face up. I'm sure the judge will fall in love with her and go easy on her. Caleb snorts but doesn't comment. I'm not sure what that means. I have asked him in a casual sort of way if he finds Natalie attractive. He did kiss her, after all, and he always reacted like I was being ridiculous. But she is attractive. He would have to be blind not to see it. I always wondered what his type is. I'm not anyone's type. I believe that he does love me. But it's despite the way I look, rather than because of it. I don't know what sort of girls Caleb dated before he dated me. I wonder if he has a thing for blondes. Most men do. If Mia were around, she could answer that question. She adored Caleb and knew absolutely everything about him.
She used to constantly mention him casually in conversation, like to tell me the TV show we were watching was his favorite, or that he taught her to hide the icky lima beans from dinner under her pillow. At the time, I wasn't terribly interested, but now I wish I had listened closer to the things she told me about him. I wish I'd come to dinner that Thanksgiving night she invited me, when Caleb was home from college and he had brought his girlfriend. That girlfriend was long gone by the time Caleb and I got together, but I wonder what she was like. He liked her enough to bring her home for Thanksgiving. I wonder if, like Natalie, she had blonde hair and blue eyes and no soul. I lie back against the mostly flat pillows on the stiff motel mattress. Do you think she could get sentenced to life in prison? Caleb rifles around in the backpack he brought with him. I don't know. Maybe. Probably. Maybe or probably. Probably. But I shift on the uncomfortable mattress. There's no dead body. Do you think they can convict her without a dead body? We looked it up. Prosecutors can convict someone if they have enough evidence to show that the victim has died. Like lack of communication problems, lack of recreational activity, bank activity, abandoning their home, and obviously signs of a crime scene. We got all that going on. Right, but it will be harder to convict her without a dead body. Harder, but there's a very good chance. But there would be a better chance if there were a dead body. Caleb stops rifling around in his bag and looks up at me. Dawn, it's really starting to upset me that you keep talking about this. There's no dead body because you're still alive. But there's not going to be a dead body. Ever. I can't argue that he hasn't made a valid point. But I can't help but feel he's not as invested in this plan as I am. He didn't even want to do it in the first place. When I suggested it, he looked at me like I was crazy. Natalie drove his sister to kill herself, and he was willing to just let it go. If I said the word, he would probably happily bring me back to Dorchester and tell the police I'm alive and well. I just want to make sure she pays for what she did, I murmur. Caleb sits beside me and the mattress makes a crunching sound. I know. I do too. But we've done all we can. I don't think it's worth taking any more risks. Yeah. He picks up my hand in his. You agree, right? Dawn? He applies firm pressure on my hand. Tell me you agree. You're not going to do anything stupid. Caleb, promise me. Promise me you're not going to do anything else. Promise me. Fine. I agree. I pull my hand away. What do you think I'm going to do anyway? He gives me a look. I don't want to think about it. He goes back to his bag, and I pick up his phone again, scrolling through the articles. The truth is, I'm just telling him what he wants to hear. He doesn't get it. There's nothing more important to me than this plan. Nothing is more important than avenging Mia's death. Even him. Even me.
Chapter 52. Natalie. I feel like a walking zombie, and am in no mood to talk to my parents. But according to one of the guards, they are on the phone. In some ways, though, my parents are my only hope. I don't have enough money in the bank to bail myself out of jail. So if I don't convince them to lend me some money, I'll be stuck here until my trial. That's not an appealing thought. The guard leads me to a bunch of phones set up on the wall. I look at the row of phones, not sure what to do. I glance over at the bald guard who isn't giving me any instructions. I say, what should I do?
You pick up the phone and talk, he barks at me.
I want to snap back at him that I know how a phone works, but I suspect that won't make my situation any better. Then I notice that one of the phones is off the hook and the receiver is lying on the counter beneath it. I reach for the receiver, which feels sticky in my hand. Hello? I croak into the receiver. Natalie! My mother's voice is far too loud, as usual. Natalie, are you okay? I'm in jail. What the hell does she think? I'm okay. Are you eating? Is there food there? Yes, there's food. This isn't a death prison. My mother is used to my sharp replies on the phone, so it surprises me when she bursts into tears, which in turn makes a lump rise in my own throat. "Natalie, how could you do this?" she sobs. I stare at the receiver, stunned. How could she think that I'm guilty? It was bad enough that Seth thought I stole money from the company. Now my own mother thinks I'm a murderer?
"I didn't do it, Mom," I whisper.
"Oh, Natalie, I didn't. How could you even think that?"
"You have to admit," she sniffles, "it's the sort of thing you would do."
I don't even know what to say to that. "It's the sort of thing I would do?"
"I mean," she goes on, "there were all those incidents when you were younger. Remember that girl you and your friend Tara bullied, and she killed herself?"
She always brings that up. It doesn't seem to matter that I have set up a charity to honor Amelia. I'm still the girl who drove her to her death. But it should be said that the police didn't even consider bringing charges against me. I was barely even questioned. I have tried to make amends. When Tara and I were writing those fake Valentines to Amelia, I never for one second believed they would make her kill herself. She seemed so much stronger than that. A fighter. Everyone was so shocked when she killed herself. And I've been trying to make it right ever since. Trying to make up for the stupid thing I did when I was too young to know better.
I was just a kid, I point out.
You're lucky they didn't throw you in prison back then.
Mom, Daddy says there's a prison in South Walpole. I think that would be the most convenient location for us to come visit you.
She's already talking about prisons, and I haven't even gone to trial yet.
Listen, I need to talk to you about money. Do you think you can lend me money for bail?
Well, how much?
I'm not sure. It's going to be a good amount. 5 figures, probably.
Oh, honey.
Please, Mom. My voice cracks. I need your help. I don't want to stay in here. It's awful.
There's a long pause on the other line, followed by shuffling. After a few seconds, my father's deep voice booms.
Natalie, you know we don't have money for this sort of thing. We live on a fixed income.
Yes, but...
Don't make us feel guilty about this, he snaps at me. Whatever you did, you need to deal with the consequences.
But I didn't do anything.
The guard notices the volume of my voice rising. He shoots me a look.
You got 1 minute left, Farrell.
Please, my voice cracks. I can't do this. I really can't.
I'm afraid you're going to have to get used to it. According to your lawyer, you're going to be in there a long time.
But, Dad!
Before I can get out the entire sentence, the guard walks over to me and hits the button to end the call. I shake my head.
You didn't even let me say goodbye.
I told you to wrap it up.
There's no sympathy in his voice. This is how I'm going to be treated from now on.
Now get back to your cell.
I allow him to march me back to the square room with the cellmate with the neck tattoos. I'm completely screwed. I don't know how I'm going to get money to make bail, especially if it's the amount that Ferguson warned me it could be. My parents can't give me the money. Kim and I don't have that kind of relationship where I could ask to borrow the money, even though she could give it to me if she wanted to, since her husband is loaded. Seth is off the table. I'll be lucky if he speaks to me again. There's no chance the bail will be less than what I have in the bank, even accounting for the fact that I only have to pay 10% to the bondsman. It looks like I'm going to be in jail for a while to come.
Chapter 53. Dawn.
The motel room is dark, and Caleb is sound asleep next to me. I was right. This new motel is no better than the other one. The bed is just as hard and uncomfortable. The television is even worse. It's mostly static. This is the kind of place to stay for one night. Maybe even just an afternoon. It's not the kind of place you live for weeks or even months. This is a necessary sacrifice, though. I clutch turtly while I watch Caleb sleep. I do that sometimes. He doesn't snore, but he breathes deeply through his mouth, and sometimes there's a little whistling sound. His hair is mussed by the pillows, falling almost into his eyes if it were a little longer. He has long eyelashes for a man, and they flutter slightly as he sleeps. Maybe he is dreaming.
I wonder what he dreams about. He told me once that he never remembers his dreams, but he must have them. Everybody dreams. Maybe he's dreaming about Natalie. The truth is, I was already in love with Caleb the first time he kissed me. We were so close by then. We saw each other constantly. And while at first we mostly talked about Mia, we had started to talk about other things. The other things were always his idea. But I never dared to imagine he might feel the same way about me that I felt about him. That first kiss was wonderful in a way I hadn't expected. I had never been kissed before, not by a man. It wasn't one of those gross kisses from the movies where a guy's tongue is practically in her stomach. It was a nice kiss. Just his soft lips on mine. He had popped a mint after dinner, so even his breath smelled nice. It was almost a chaste kiss, although when I looked at his face, there was no doubt about his intentions. It turned out he felt the same way about me that I did about him. He took things so slowly for my sake. He was just satisfied for a long time, just holding hands and kissing. He bought me thoughtful presents, like a gold chain with a turtle charm on it. We were together almost a year before we made love. I won't lie, I was terrified. He was really slow and careful about it, though. He made it special. Before Caleb, I had crushes on boys, but I was realistic that none of them could ever really like me. But it isn't like that for him. When Caleb asked Natalie if she wanted to go to dinner, she gave him a quick yes. He didn't even have to talk her into it. She liked him. I remember once I saw them in the break room together having lunch. They looked like such a normal couple. They were having an easy conversation that had nothing to do with turtles or revenge. He made a joke and she laughed. A genuine laugh. That never happens to me. When I'm with another person and they laugh, either it's polite laughter or else they're laughing at me. It was at that moment that I realized Caleb is normal. He isn't like me at all. We both got caught up in getting justice for Mia. But aside from that, we have nothing in common. Mia is our only bond, and eventually, he will realize it. He was lying when he said he felt nothing for Natalie. The image she puts forth is extremely likable. She's the sort of person everybody gravitates towards. She's always been that way. A golden girl. Not everyone realizes what a snake she is. That she will smile to your face and then stab you in the back. She invites everyone to parties, but schedules them for times she knows only her favorite people will be available. She lies to customers. She slept with another woman's husband and destroyed his marriage. Tomorrow morning they will probably have a bail hearing for Natalie. She's been in jail all weekend, which is a good start, but not enough. I'm hoping all the evidence Caleb planted, her fingerprints on the glasses, the hair and blood in her car, the ceramic turtle in her laundry hamper, will mean she's stuck in jail until the trial. Even now that the DNA evidence has shown the random mystery body wasn't mine, Natalie doesn't have much money. She lives beyond her means, and her parents are as broke as mine. Ultimately, though, there's one big problem. They're trying to convict Natalie of murder, but there's no dead body. There's no solid evidence that a murder has even been committed. My left wrist throbs under the bandage, but there's no fresh blood on it. Caleb was against me cutting myself that way. He thought it was too risky, especially since that's the way Mia died. But I was careful about it. I didn't cut too deep. There had to be blood on the floor. Otherwise, the police might just think I went away on vacation. There had to be convincing evidence of foul play. I climb out of bed as quietly as I can. Caleb stirs briefly on the mattress, but then he goes back to sleep. He's a very sound sleeper. I know everything about him. Maybe even more than Mia knew when she was alive. I know that he loves to belt out rock songs in the shower, even though he can't hold a tune. I know that his least favorite food is pickles. He can't eat anything that has even touched a pickle. I know his shoes are a size 10. And I know that he has spent the last 13 years beating himself up for not protecting his little sister. Caleb's jacket is hanging on the coat rack by the door. I stick my hand into one of the pockets, searching for his phone. I pull out a couple of crumpled napkins, which I throw in the garbage. I hate when he sticks napkins in his pocket. He always does that. I feel around in his pocket again, and my hands close around a rectangular object. I pull out the object. It's a small blue velvet box. Oh no, he bought a ring. I don't open it. I can't. He's been talking about getting married when all this was done, although I don't know how we're going to do it if the police are supposed to think I'm dead. He's very logical about most things, but he hasn't thought this through at all. He just wants to marry me, but he doesn't see how much of a mistake that would be. Not just because of Natalie. In general, it would be a mistake. He doesn't want to be stuck with me for the rest of his life. He's gotten all mixed up in his head because he feels so awful about what happened to Mia. He feels responsible for me. I stick the ring box back in his pocket. I'm going to pretend I didn't find that. His phone is in the other pocket. I type in the 6-digit code to unlock the screen. He is comfortable enough with me to entrust me with this information. I wonder if Natalie knows it too. I wouldn't be entirely surprised, even though it would have been a big risk. There were things on that phone we wouldn't have wanted her to discover, like the recording he took of me crying, "Help me," in a tearful voice. That was Caleb's idea. He figured that phone call would get someone investigating my house faster. And it worked, although it would have been better if she hadn't gone over there herself, because that gave her a way to explain all the fingerprints. We planned this out so well. There's only one missing piece. It's finally clear to me how this is all supposed to end. Really, I knew all along. I just didn't want to admit it to myself. When Caleb and I first discussed this plan, I liked the idea of starting over again with a new identity, not having to be Dawn Schiff anymore. I should have known from the start it would never go that way. Caleb and I didn't get together so we would fall in love. We got together so we could get justice for Mia, to make Natalie pay for driving her to suicide. There's only one way that that can happen. There's only one way that Natalie will go down hard. There needs to be a dead body, and it needs to be mine. Chapter 54, Natalie. The bail hearing goes as well as it possibly could, meaning the judge grants me bail as long as I surrender my passport. Unfortunately, it's a stupidly high amount that I could never afford. Even the 10% bond is a higher amount than I can afford, which means I will remain incarcerated until my trial, at which point I will almost certainly be sentenced to some sort of prison time. I'm going to spend the next several years behind bars, if I'm lucky. However, the overwhelming likelihood, Ferguson has assured me, is that the DA will go after a murder one charge. He updated me this morning that they don't seem interested in seeking a deal. This has been a very high-profile case because of the accusations in Dawn's emails, and they want to make sure I receive the punishment I deserve. They feel confident there's enough evidence of foul play that they can convict me without a body. They want me to go to prison for the rest of my life. They want me to die behind bars. As I said in my jail cell, all I can think about is how badly I want to go home. I want to take a shower in my own bathroom. I want to eat a giant, juicy cheeseburger. I want to lie in my own bed, all alone, with a cozy blanket and sleep as long as I want in the morning. But I have a sick feeling that's never going to be my life ever again. At least, not for a long time. So I'm nothing short of shocked when one of the guards calls out my name. "Farrell, your bail has been posted." "What?" I leap off the bench in my horrible cell, where I've been sitting and feeling sorry for myself. "By who?" The guard just shrugs, and it's not like I'm going to interrogate him. I just want out of here, even if it's for a few weeks until my trial. It's only after I get back my phone and wallet and other belongings that they lead me to the waiting room, and I discover who my benefactor is. It's the last person I expected.
Hey, Nat, Seth says.
He must have come straight from work, because he's wearing a dress shirt and tie. He looks tired, but I'm sure I look much worse. My hair feels like a rat's nest. I'm scared to even run my fingers through it.
What are you doing here? I ask. I thought you hated me.
He offers me a crooked smile.
Let's talk in the car, okay?
I'm not going to say no. I'm tired and hungry, and all I want is to go home. So even if he's going to berate me for the entire ride home, I'll still take it. I follow Seth out to the parking lot, where his Audi is waiting for us. I get into the passenger seat, rest my head against the headrest, and shut my eyes. If I'm not careful, I'm going to fall asleep right here and now. I never want to go back in there. Ever. Seth climbs into the car beside me. He starts up the engine and we're off. I watch his profile, wondering what his game is. The last time I saw him, he was furious and hurt, accusing me of stealing money from the company. But he doesn't seem angry anymore.
So, he finally says, I checked through all the accounts, and there was no money missing.
What a shock. He frowns.
I'm sorry. I should have believed you. But that detective came in, and he sounded so sure of himself.
Uh-huh.
I'm really sorry.
His voice cracks slightly.
He got to me. I should have known you would never do something like that.
He feels bad about it, and he's here, which means a lot. Nobody else is here for me. Yes, he was awful to me, but I can forgive him.
I can't believe you paid the bail. That was a lot of money.
I've got the money. He lifts his shoulder. You did me a favor. It's less in my bank account for Melinda to get her hands on. Also, you need a decent lawyer. That Ferguson guy I talked to was awful. What is he, 12 years old? I'm going to help you out with this.
I don't want to owe Seth anything. But at the same time, I'm in no position to refuse. He's right. I need a decent lawyer. One who graduated from law school more than 6 months ago.
I didn't do anything to Dawn, you know, I say.
I know. This whole thing is ridiculous. We'll get it all sorted out.
He believes me. It feels like he's the only person who does. Even my parents think I'm guilty. They think I'm a terrible person. All because of that incident in high school with that girl, Amelia.
Are you hungry?
He asks. It's nearly lunchtime.
We can grab some food.
I swallow a lump in my throat. I just want to go home.
You got it.
While he's driving, I check the messages on my phone. There are about 5 billion messages and voicemails. I don't have the energy to deal with all of these. Not now. Then I notice a text from Caleb. He sent it on Saturday evening.
Checked out the motel. Nothing there. Seems like a dead end.
I stare down at the text message. A few days ago, I would have felt grateful to him for driving all the way down to Rhode Island for me. But now I'm not so sure what to think. I thought Santoro bullied Caleb into ratting me out. But it turns out it was the opposite. Caleb went to the police himself. He voluntarily told them my alibi was a lie. And he said a lot of other things.
Was Caleb at work today? I ask.
Seth shakes his head.
Didn't see him, but I'm sure he'll come over and see you, if that's what you want.
It's not what I want, though. I don't trust Caleb anymore. He turned on me, and I'm not sure why.
What do you think of Caleb? I blurt out.
Well, I think you could do better, obviously.
Seriously, Seth?
I don't know.
He pushes his palm down on his horn as a Subaru cuts him off.
Selfishly, I don't like him. I don't think he's been very supportive of you through this whole thing. But he seems like a nice enough person, I guess. And I'm sure he's just worried about Dawn.
Why would he be so worried about Dawn? He hardly knows her. Seth glances at me.
What are you talking about? They know each other. She was the one who recommended him to me for the website job.
What? My world has suddenly gone on tilt. Dawn was the one who recommended Caleb. How could that be? They never spoke to each other, except for a polite hello. A few times Caleb even got her name wrong.
which now seems increasingly suspicious.
"Oh, yeah," he confirms. "She went on and on about him. You know how she does that. Gets stuck on some topic and won't shut up about it."
Holy crap. It suddenly occurs to me that Caleb had easy access to my house, more than practically anyone else. Could he have planted that turtle in my laundry hamper? And he could easily have gotten into my trunk. Since he was at the office, he could have put those turtles on my desk every day. And how many times have I drunk wine glasses in his apartment, then left them behind with my fingerprints on them? It hits me that when Caleb took away my alibi, he also eliminated his own. He has no alibi for the night Dawn was killed. Moreover, he was the one who told me he was tired and wanted to head out early. I was trying to get him to stay. Is it possible that Caleb murdered Dawn and he's trying to pin it on me? It seems crazy, but in a strange way, it makes sense. It's the only thing that makes sense. But why? That motel. I've got to get over there. Chapter 55. During the rest of the drive home, I explain the situation to Seth. Whatever else I can say about Seth, I trust him. He'll give me sound advice. I just need to take a shower and change. I'm still stuck in the clothing I wore to the race on Saturday morning. I can't wait to peel it off my body. Then I'm going to head out to the motel.
I'm coming with you,